It was incredible how swiftly he'd accepted his fate, adapted his whole plan. Deep down, he must have known this day would come. While he'd been playing spy games, his inner wolf had been preparing for the moment he'd have to jump out of the metaphorical window. Either that, or he was just damn good at this. He tore out of the city, raced down the road toward Dullendon, then veered southwest into the vacant hills. By early evening, with spears of yellow light shooting in from the west, he stopped atop a ridge to give the horse a breather and to scan the lands behind him. No sign of pursuit. But Dante would come. Blaze couldn't rule out the king, either. Modigan had nethermancers of his own, and who knew what tricks they had tucked in their voluminous sleeves? Additionally, Modigan must be highly confused. He had apparently been conned by an impostor, an enemy, into parting with a fortune. Yet, the bosun was legit. He'd be highly motivated to hunt Blaze down and hang him by his thumbs, until he revealed the purpose behind his scam. That, in turn, meant Blaze was highly motivated to continue running as fast as humanly possible, or, more accurately, as fast as equestrianly possible. Tragically, his mount was already beginning to flag. Farms dotted the landscape, snugged into the draws between hills where streams flowed north toward Setevan. Blaze stopped at a house, spoke with the farmer who lived there, and arranged to swap his exhausted horse for a fresh one. The farmer cannily extracted two precious rings from Blaze as well. An outrageous price in the normal world, but Blaze would soon have no cause for money. Besides his blades, the only thing his current possessions were good for was to get him to his destination. Blaze made sure to snag a lantern and oil in the deal. He knew he'd have to sleep eventually, but he wanted to put more miles behind him first. If a broken leg befell his horse, a sturdy workhorse but rather less impressive than the fancy-stepping palace mount he'd just left behind, Dante would catch him within a day. Trails snaked through the hills, but nothing you'd call a proper road. For the most part, he had to travel the night at a walk, picking his way forward with the help of the lantern and the moon. By midnight, he'd had enough. He camped in a draw, tearing up brush and grass to form a rudimentary cave tent. But he'd forgotten to get blankets from the farmer. And that night, the cold autumn wind nearly killed him. He got up after a few hours, less from the urge to keep moving as from the need to stir his limbs enough to get warm again. Stiff, sore, exhausted, hungry, and generally miserable, he continued across the hills, pushing the horse to a trot here and there, but mostly sticking to a walk that would preserve their collective endurance. He cursed Dante's name the whole while. He descended from the hills into a plain bordered by the mountains of Galador Rift to the east and by Vossen Forest to the west. He stopped at another farmhouse and traded a silver necklace for meat pies, baked potatoes, a sack of walnuts, and two thick blankets. He almost asked for a quick nap in a bed, but there was no getting around the fact the next couple days would be a living hell. He just had to make it through. He carried on. Sometimes he dozed in the saddle, but despite the lack of roads, he wasn't concerned about going off course. Hemmed in by mountains and forest, the way forward was clear. Miles came and went. His horse wouldn't win any shows, but it had been trained to endure, and he only spent two more nights in the wilds. He was so tired that, when he first saw the sheer black cliffs of Pocket Cove, he thought they were a mirage. He rode up and touched the cool basalt. The cliffs rose monolithically, sweeping north to south, blocking all entry to the bay on the other side. He dismounted, legs aching. Wind whistled through the prairie. He waved his hands over his head and shouted as loud as he could, "Hello! Hello!" Nothing. Just as he'd expected. He led the horse south along the wall, stopping every few hundred feet to shout some more. After 3 hours, he searched the spot in the wall where the hidden staircase was, more accurately, where it had been. First in his excitement, and then in his exhaustion, he'd forgotten the people of the pocket had crumbled it into rubble. "Hello," he said. "Listen, I know you're up there. I've met you, and if one of you doesn't have the courtesy to come give me a wave, I'll climb up there hand over hand." The whooshing wind was his only reply. He added a sigh to it, got down from his horse and began to climb. It wasn't easy. The cliffs were almost smooth, and he didn't have anything in the way of equipment. Instead, he had one extremely effective tool. Maniacal determination. 8 feet up, as he clung to a 2-inch ledge, the rock beneath his fingertips disappeared. He fell to the ground, landing in a low, knee-jarring crouch. He tipped back his head and smiled wryly. Far up the cliff, a head poked over the edge. "If you try that again," the woman said, voice carrying with unnatural vigor, "I'll wait to drop you until you're 100 feet up." "There you are," he said. "Do they leave one of you unfortunate souls posted up there all day? We keep watch on our walls. So, have any of your friends recognized me? I'm Blaze Buckler. Visited you a few years back. I had a friend with me named Dante." "I remember," she said. "We haven't had another visitor since." Blaze nodded and took a drink to soothe his throat. "Well, Dante figured out how to move the earth around like you guys do. With a vengeance. If you don't let me in, I'll sneak around the coast and into Pocket Cove when you least expect it. To find me, he'll tear down the cliffs." "If we let you inside, what would stop him from tearing down the cliffs anyway?" "At least you'll know when he's coming, and I'll do my best to talk him into leaving." She lifted her head to look across the plains. Blaze followed her. Miles away, 3 silhouetted riders moved across a ridge and dropped from sight, heading west.
"What exactly do you want?" the woman said.
"To learn what you do best. How to disappear."
"Those who come in can't ever leave."
"Perfect," Blaze said. "Where do I sign?"
"One moment."
The woman withdrew from the cliff. The wind stirred the grass. A minute ticked by. As Blaze prepared to call to her and demand an answer, stone groaned across the plains. Before his eyes, a staircase appeared in the side of the cliff. Blaze grinned and started up. Chapter 9. The dark curtain stood on the prairie, like a wall at the end of the world. Dante sighed and cursed simultaneously.
"What is it?" Lou said. "Did we go the wrong way? Is that a dead end?"
"Yes, which only proves we're in the right place." Dante shifted in the saddle. "Give me a minute to think." He'd come so close. Since riding from Setevan 2 days ago, the pressure in his head had mounted steadily. And in the last hour, that pressure, the physical manifestation of an ethereal link between Blaze and the blood Dante had collected on the handkerchief, had accelerated. That meant Blaze had stopped, stymied, most likely, by the cliffs of Pocket Cove. Dante knew that Blaze wouldn't have dashed all the way out here without some sort of plan for entry, but the people of the pocket, A, didn't know Blaze was coming, and B, were notoriously inhospitable, which was likely the very reason Blaze was gambling on this approach. There had been a chance, in other words, for Dante to catch him again. He'd sent another burst of nether through their horses' veins to cleanse them of their aches and fatigue, then galloped across the prairie. And then the pressure had begun to slacken. Blaze was moving away from Dante. Somehow he'd gotten inside. Considering Blaze's head start, it was a miracle they'd come this close to him, Blaze's stunt at the palace had caught Dante completely off guard. He'd been so startled by the fact Blaze had shoved him off the railing that, before he hit the ground, he'd had no time to do more than clutch his arms to his head and yelp. He woke in a stone room. Four guards and two old men in robes whirled to face the bed, feet shuffling as they stepped back. Dante's left arm and hip throbbed dully. His head ached much worse. Not all the way conscious, he drew on the nether. The robed men shouted. Pale ether crackled in the air. Dante went very still. That pause allowed them to explain. They were Modigan's court ethermancers. In the fall from the terrace, Dante had broken his arm, chipped his hip, and rattled his head. They'd healed him. This was confusing, especially in his addled state, but over the following hours of discussion, his status clarified. He wasn't a prisoner per se, although he wasn't allowed to leave despite his urgent protestations. Eventually, the court interrogator downgraded him from potential assassin to... ? At that point, Modigan himself stepped in for a brief conversation. Because Dante was a fellow regent. Even if he and Modigan were dire enemies, which they no longer were, Dante would have been afforded the special privileges that were his due. By definition, a ruler bore the mandate of Aron. You couldn't disrespect that without weakening your own status as king. Not to mention degrading yourself in the eyes of other regents who might not feel compelled to treat you any better should you, someday, wind up in their hands. Additionally, Modigan seemed to understand Dante hadn't come to Setevan to hurt him. If anything, given Modigan's line of questions, Dante deduced that he believed Dante's exposure of Blaze had helped save him from something. The long and short of it was that, while the events in the palace had been shocking and remained opaque, Modigan had no reason to believe Dante knew any more than he did. Their nations weren't at war, or particularly close to it. The crown appeared safe. Even so, had Dante been a commoner, he never would have seen the light of day again. Instead, he was told that the court would continue to investigate, and that if they determined Dante had come to the palace for hostile intent, the consequences would be sinister. Then he was released. All told, he'd lost less than 24 hours. A frantic scramble to the southwest ensued. By the time he, Lou, and C took their first rest, Dante had guessed where Blaze was headed. And here they were, at the indomitable cliffs of Pocket Cove. Following the pressure in his head, he rode to their base and threw back his shoulders. "I am Dante Galland, High Priest of the Council of Narashtavik. You will give me Blaze Buckler, or I will come in and take him." Grass whispered to itself. High above, the cliffs remained vacant. "Do you think they heard it?" Lou said. "Absolutely. Blaze will have warned him." "They're the people of the pocket," C said. "They don't talk to anyone." "They'll hear this," Dante said. He cut his arm and wiped the blood across his palm. Nether bloomed. He delved into the shadows lurking in the rock atop the cliff and coaxed them away. Stone flowed like tepid bacon grease, revealing the first turn of a new staircase. 5 heads popped up from the cliffs. "Stop that," a woman said. "Sure," Dante replied. "All you have to do is give me Blaze." "No one goes in or out." "Then how did Blaze get in? Give me the same exemption you gave him." "Leave now," she said, "before you're left to fertilize the prairie instead." "If that's how you want to play it." Dante focused on the cliff and began to carve another segment of stairs. He'd no sooner touched the nether in the rock than a flood of shadows gushed through the earth toward his work. He shouted, redoubling his strength, but the combined efforts of the pocket's defenders dashed his hold, erasing the steps from the top of the cliffs. "First warning," another woman called. "The next time, we bury you and your friends alive."
"I don't want to be buried," Lou hissed. "Can't you negotiate?
Why does it always have to be the crushing of them by you?
Quit cowering, Dante scowled.
He tipped back his head to call up to the cliffs.
Why does he matter to you?
Because he does, the first woman said.
See, that's not actually a reason. I won't hurt him, I'm his friend.
You don't understand. He's passed into the pocket. Your previous lives, whatever your connection to him, none of it matters now.
These are the last words we give you, the second woman said. Now go.
Dante nodded slowly. A hawk shrieked from the vacant blue sky. He turned his horse and strolled away from the cliffs. The others didn't speak. After he'd gotten a half mile from the black wall, the sun descending on the west, he stopped, dismounted, and made camp.
Still some daylight left, C said.
I see that.
Daylight that can be used to distance ourselves from this creepy ghostland.
Dante pulled a towel from the bags and rubbed his horse's flank, settling in.
We're not done here.
C rolled her eyes.
Sure, in the technical sense that you can stay here until you starve, it's not over. But in the sense that you will never, ever get into Pocket Cove, it's done. Let's go home.
You want a position at Narashtovik? Then you start now.
Dante pointed at the dark line of the cliffs. Your first job is to get me inside the pocket.
She reached for a water skin and said nothing. Lou gazed at the grass.
It seems like he doesn't want to be found. If you get to him again, what are you going to do?
Talk to him, Dante said. Get him to see reason.
The others fell silent. They strung up canvas tarps to block the wind. The night was frigid. Small creatures rustled, foraging for seeds. Dante woke in the darkness, killed a rat with a pinpoint of nether, and delved his sight into its dead eyes. He directed it to run across the flat ground to the rocky scree beneath the basalt walls. The rat's claws hooked into nooks in the stone, ascending. When the wind gusted, it flattened itself against the wall. It was three quarters of the way up the heights when a bolt of nether lashed down from above. Dante's second sight winked out. With dawn glowing to the east, someone cleared their throat. It repeated. Dante opened his eyes.
Are you out there? Nack said through the loon.
Where else would I be? Dante said, phlegm catching in his throat.
Give me your comings and goings. For all I know, you're on Aron's grassy hill, or underneath the sea, demanding the crabs tell you when they last saw blaze.
What do you want?
For you to do something about the infestation.
Nack, do you have any idea how early in the morning it is? Start talking sense, or I'll throw this loon in a lake.
The infestation of Norrin, in our plaza.
Dante rolled to his side and sat up.
Norrin? Has something happened in Gask?
Why does it sound like that wouldn't surprise you?
Nack said.
They came to tell us they've seen lights in the hills near the Dundons. Strange creatures. Oh, and a man named Hop claims that if you continue to defy him with your non-presence, he'll... send you downstream like the good old days.
Does that mean anything to you?
Unfortunately, Dante said.
Specifically, it was a threat to drown him, like Blaze almost had during the admission trial to Hop's clan of the Broken Herons, which Dante still belonged to. Dante might be a great lord and master in the human world, but among the Norrin he was a common clansman, beholden to the orders of his chief, assuming, of course, he cared to honor his part. He found that he did. While his time fighting alongside the Norrin felt like it belonged to an earlier stage of his life, in fact he hadn't seen Hop in over a year, it still held meaning to him. He might have respected his chieftain's wishes, even if Hop hadn't been bearing news about the same phenomenon they'd witnessed in the Wodens.
Tell him to stay put, Dante said. We'll be back as soon as we can.
And how long will that be?
Knack said. A week, no more than 10 days.
10 days? Where are you? The moon?
Dante glanced at the cliffs.
In one sense, it's even further.
I'm not going to bother to ask what that means, Knack said. See you when I see you.
The connection dropped.
We're going back to Narashtivik, Dante informed the others once they were up.
Does your brain sweat or something? C said. You change your mind like some men change socks.
There's no getting inside. I can't handle the people of the pocket by myself, and there are more pressing matters at home.
Like what?
Large, furry men who get grumpy when you make them wait.
They ate and rode out.
With no desire to risk any further troubles in Setevan, Dante set a course dead east towards the peaks of Galador. They found a trail across the prairie and rode hard. When their horses tired, he showed Lou how to soothe their exhaustion. Though the young monk was talented and a quick learner, there was only so much the Nether could do for the animals, who still required regular rests and sleep, as did the humans. Regardless, they made great time, and soon reached the paved road into the mountains of Galador Rift. The lakes glittered below them. In less trying circumstances, he would have paid a visit to Lolligan, to catch up and hear for himself how things stood between the Gascon Empire and the semi-breakaway state of Galador, but that could wait for a later day. The events in the hinterlands troubled him, mostly because nobody seemed to have a single clue what they meant. They crossed the basin and the mountains to the east, then descended to the wheat fields of Tatonen. Oxen lowed, ploughing rows of winter wheat. The land looked at peace. Dante stopped to purchase supplies, then took the northern road all the way to Narashtivik. He wasn't sure of the distance they'd crossed between the city and Pocket Cove. 800 miles? Amazing how fast you could move with proper roads and magically enhanced mounts. Past the inn gate, a makeshift village of tents and yurts filled the square between the Cathedral of Ivars and the walls of the sealed citadel. Norrin men and women sewed clothes, smoked fish, and chipped arrows from flakes of obsidian, as if they were off in the lonely hills, instead of occupying one of the busiest plazas in one of the largest cities in the known world. A yurt flapped open. Hop strode into the sunlight. To Dante's mild surprise, he was still beardless, continuing to display the circled R branded on his right cheek, relic of the days not so long ago when Norrin had been property rather than people.
"This is how you treat your chieftain's orders," he boomed. "By dawdling."
"Dawdling," Dante said. "Tell that to our overworked horses, if you're prepared to get trampled."
"Such insouciance calls for a public flogging."
He turned and flung out his hands.
"Men, where is my cat on 99 tails?
"Please, sir," Lou said. "We came as fast as we could, all the way from Pocket Cove."
Hop turned on him, glowering down at him from a height of 7 feet. Lou raised a hand to protect his face. Unable to take it any longer, Hop burst out laughing.
"What the hell were you doing at Pocket Cove?"
"Admiring the scenery," Dante said. "What the hell are you doing camped in the middle of Narashtivik?"
"Coming to see you. Is that a problem?"
"The whole clan?"
Hop squinted, then nodded broadly.
"This is strange to you because you are a human, and humans don't like to leave their homes.
Whereas if you're Norrin," Dante said, "the entire world is your home."
"Close. The clan is our home. So it would be more strange for a few of us to leave the others behind than for us to bring the entire band."
Dante glanced across the men and women of the Broken Herons. He still recognized nearly all of them.
"You look well. Has there been any trouble?"
"That is a worthless question," Pop laughed. "When is the answer not yes?"
"Rather than playing games, why not tell me what brought you here?"
Dante gestured to the citadel gates. Should we talk inside? Ollivander will want to hear this. Is he too good to come and join us in the fresh air? Beside Dante, Lou looked like his eyes might explode. C smirked. Dante scratched the back of his neck. He's a military man. They guard intelligence like they gave birth to it. On the other hand, if we speak in the open, that makes it less likely he'll flay me alive. I'll ask him to come down. He called up to the gatekeepers to send for Gant. A minute later, the majordomo emerged, listened intently to Dante's request, and returned inside. Soon enough, Ollivander exited the gates. Burly and bearded enough to be mistaken for one of the Norren, though half a foot too short. He saw Dante and suppressed a flicker of emotion. He nodded to Hop.
Ready to talk?
I've been ready since I got here.
The Norren raised his thick brows.
It's your future commander who's caused the delays.
Well, we're all here now.
Ollivander gestured to Hop's yurt. Shall we? A more ornery Norren might have insisted they stay outside, but Hop was unusually easygoing for a clan chief and agreed without issue. He, Ollivander, and Dante walked inside a warm, round room of wool blankets and fur pillows. In the corner, an old woman gazed at them from the darkness.
She's trustworthy, Ollivander said.
Hop shrugged. More than I am.
They settled onto the pillows, sitting cross-legged. The familiarity between Hop and Ollivander suggested they had spoken more than once while waiting for Dante to cross the western continent.
We have been troubled, Hop said. We know our lands like no other, but things have appeared that are strange to us. Lights in the skies, patterns, animals we've never seen, or which at least we can't remember having seen before.
Kappers, Dante said.
Hop shook his head.
Kappers never leave the Wodens, which is why Norren never enter the Wodens.
Then what are they?
How should I know the name of something I've never seen before?
The power of description might prove helpful.
One is like a rabbit, Hop said, except for fangs.
Dante stared at him, trying to determine if this was a jest.
Are they aggressive?
Not to date.
Either you missed me more than I could imagine, or you came here to tell us about something more than pretty lights and carnivorous rabbits.
It isn't a rabbit, the Norren snorted. I said it looks like one, but yes, I came to tell you a story.
A story, Ollivander said. An old story, but aren't they all? This story says that, many years ago, lights shined from the hills, from the peaks, from all the high places. The nights aglow with colors never seen by day. Some feared this, and fled to the low places. Others stayed put in their tents, but others were curious, and their curiosity lured them to the peaks. Among these was a woman named Yona. She went into the mountains with a spear and a bow of many arrows, because she may have been curious, but she was also prudent. This was good, because the lights attracted other creatures besides people. The Hollan, the Crocs, the Dog of Six Arms. On her way up the heights, Yona slew more than a few. But this is not a story about how an armed person was able to destroy unarmed animals. So, each night the lights streamed above her. Each day she climbed closer to their source in the sky, until one night she found herself right beneath them. The lights danced close, as if daring her to touch them, but every time she reached up they flicked away. For 3 nights she chased them. Once her hand came so close, she felt the light's cold heat on her skin, but she was never able to touch them. So she sat on the cold turf and thought. Rains came, soaking her to the bone, but still she sat, reflecting. When night came again, she moved to a pool of rainwater. The lights soared across the sky. She jumped to reach them, and again
they danced away. She grinned, knelt beside the pool, and touched their reflection in the water. No sooner had she done so, when Joson Joe, Lord of all things, special guide to the Norren, who are his...
I know who Joson Joe is, Dante said.
Hop cocked a thick brow. Does your friend? Ollivander glanced around the yurt. I've heard of him. But you don't know him. So it is good to be reminded. Besides, he glared at Dante, it is how the story goes. Dante opened one palm. By all means, proceed. Hop frowned at the corner of the yurt, casting about for the thread of his story. If you're so impatient, I'll abbreviate. Joson Joe appeared to Yona. He looked her from head to toe and said, Why did you come here? Yona shrugged and replied, Because there were lights. You found the way to them, Joson Joe said. Now find me the Black Star.
What is the Black Star?
Yona asked. And Joson Joe said, Just as it sounds. Yona did as she was tasked, and when she delivered the Black Star to Joson Joe, together they lifted the drought that had blighted the lands. Hop sat back. Dante waited a couple of seconds. That's it. That's why I think it is a very old story, Hop said. Their endings are never any good. If this is one of your Norren metaphors, I don't get it. Neither do I, the chieftain said, but I knew that you would want to have it at hand, and since it is a Norren story, I doubted that you would have encountered it before. The yurt was quiet for a moment. Outside, members of the Broken Herons chattered and laughed. Selen, Ollivander said. The word tickled Dante's memory. From the Cycle of Aron. It's hardly mentioned, and the story is nothing like Yona's. Yet the name is the same. Black Star. It was true. Dante hadn't drawn an immediate connection because Hop had pronounced the word in a Norren dialect. He tapped his fingers together. So, these events have happened before. With significant impact, Ollivander said. Indubitably. That's why nobody's any clue what's happening, and we have to hear about it in a Norren story that's as obscure as it is cryptic. Ollivander gave him the eye. Hop, does Yona reappear in any other tales? Not that I recall, Hop said, but I always thought her story was too boring to want to hear any more of it. I'll ask my people. Thank you. He turned to Dante. Why don't we step inside the citadel? That didn't sound like Dante's idea of a good time, but he had little choice. He exited the yurt and gestured for Lou and C to follow Ollivander through the gates to the courtyard. Inside the citadel proper, Gant moved to intercept C and Lou while Ollivander and Dante continued upstairs. Once inside Ollivander's chambers, the big man closed the door and stood facing it, back to Dante. Where were you? Chasing rumors of the lights, Dante said. Is that so? To such distant corners of the earth it took you 10 days to return once summoned? By the way, who gave you permission to depart on this venture? I wasn't aware council members had to seek permission to step outside. Ollivander turned halfway, his face darkened with disappointment. Brush this off at your peril. Dante lowered his gaze. It won't happen again. No, Ollivander sighed. It won't. Is that a threat? Being a leader means making your responsibility the core of your being. In troubled times, everyone in this city relies on you. How can I entrust tens of thousands of lives to someone who thinks nothing of running off whenever it suits him? I take your lesson to heart, Dante said. So, what would you have me do for our city?
Ollivander looked up sharply. I don't need you submissive and defeated. I need you to be the man who earns the head of this council. Driven, creative, and defiant.
In that spirit, fuck you, sir.
Ollivander snorted.
Very good. Now, what were you really up to out there?
I found Blaze.
The Hunts took me across Garsk.
There may have been an incident with King Modigan.
He winced, then decided, what the hell?
There was an incident. I believe it's blown over, but I'll write it up for you. We may want to dispatch one of Somber's people to soothe any wounds.
Should I be angry?
Modigan had me and let me go, if that means anything to you.
Quite a lot.
As is the fact you're back and Blaze is not. Not like you to let what you want get away.
Well, it's not like him to do anything he doesn't want. My attempt to set things right didn't go as well as I'd planned.
Dante glanced toward the window.
In any event, there's nothing more I can do about it.
So what about Selin? Do you think it's serious?
I have no idea, Ollivander said, and that is why I'm so concerned.
I'll look into it.
He met Ollivander's eyes. If that's okay with you.
The big man chuckled.
Do your worst.
Dante returned downstairs and had Gant round up Lou and C. He dispatched Lou to the archives to search for any mention of Selin or Yona. Once the monk was gone, Dante turned to C. Are you only good at finding people, or are your talents more versatile?
She squinted at him.
Are you asking me if I can find books?
It doesn't have to be books. It can be anything with a record or mention of what's happening.
What do you think is happening?
I don't know.
C rolled her eyes.
Sure. You're clueless. That's why you're running after it like a 13-year-old who's just glimpsed his first bare ass.
Typically, I would dismiss Hop's story as typical Norran obscurity, he said. But this time their legend matches what we're seeing.
He gazed across the courtyard.
You found Blaze. You earned yourself a job. Now find me everything there is to find.
She saluted mockingly and exited through the front gate.
Dante ran upstairs to his room and opened the Cycle of Aron across his desk. He had whole passages of it memorized and found the mention of Selin without the need to check the monk's indexes. But that mention was no more than a blink.
And Selin slipped through the skies, a dark pearl in a black sea, while bright stars flashed on all sides, as common as the sand.
That was it. There was little to be gleaned from the context either, a story of sorcerous warfare in an eastern kingdom that had probably never actually existed.
Dante read the passage three times, but found no hidden meaning.
Not that he'd expected it to be that easy. Carrying the cycle, he went into the hallway, walked past the tapestries depicting the white tree, and knocked on Tarkon's door. The old man met him with a smile and led the way to the balcony where he'd been drinking tea and watching the city go about its business.
What do you know about Selin? Dante asked.
Selin?
His brows banged together.
About as much as I know about the magical alchemical process that transmutes food into dung.
The man had to be 90 or better, but his wits seemed ageless. Dante smiled.
Yet you recognize it.
Cimmerans talked about it from time to time. I never paid it much mind. You know how she was about her prophecies.
Dante nodded vaguely. He'd only known the former leader of the council for a few months, and at the time he'd been less concerned with getting to know her than he'd been with exterminating her. She had died by Kali's hand during a highly questionable attempt to summon Aron himself to lead her followers to victory in Malon.
Her willingness to believe his avatar would appear to her cast shade on anything she might have believed,
yet the woman had been a brilliant nethermancer and a powerful leader. Anyway, considering Dante was currently chasing a Norrin myth, it was hard to be too harsh in his judgment. I never got to know her that well. What did she have to say about Selin? Tarkin sipped his tea and scratched the back of his ear.
Gibberish, mostly. I got the sense she thought it was a tangible object, something you could take hold of. What stuck with me most is she was most keen on making sure nobody else got it.
Why was that? Dante said.
Search me. These days my memory's a sieve. She never trusted me enough to fill me in on her schemes.
Dante stood. If you think of anything else, please let me know.
There might be more about it in her rooms, Tarkin said.
Callie's chambers? There's nothing left of hers in there.
No, her rooms. Downstairs.
The existence of these was news to Dante. As soon as Gant led him downstairs, past the main basement and the dungeons, and into a cramped staircase Dante hadn't even known existed, it was clear that Samaran's trove had been well known to Callie. The old man's notes were all over her collection of scrolls, folios, and notebooks, which filled multiple shelves and several desks. There were artifacts, too. Bottles of colorful oils, a bucket of stones and gems, two complete possum skeletons held together with wires and glue, driftwood planks carved with foreign runes, silver goblets and flatware. All of it was cobwebbed, dusty, yellow-gray with age. Some of the items were so time-weathered Dante wasn't certain exactly what they were. One item stood out like a lantern on a midnight hill, an object Dante had thought long lost. A 4-foot rib bone, shaken from Bardon itself during the battle that had taken Samaran's life. Its edge held a terrible, undulling sharpness. Callie had done some work on it early on, then declared it required much more study. Supposedly, he tasked a team of monks with it, but somehow the bone had just wound up down here. Dante couldn't guess why. It would have been just a little useful during the war. Perhaps the old man's mind hadn't been as coherent as Dante thought. Perhaps it had been brought here during the war, hidden out of the way, where Modigan's people would be unlikely to find it. Or maybe Callie had simply stored it here with the intention of returning to it later, but the constant business of Narashtovic had left it forgotten. Much of Samaran's collection was quite interesting, but it wasn't what Dante was after. He ordered the servants to help him carry Samaran's prodigious volumes up to Callie's room, then dove into the work. For days he pored over her writing, skimming where he could, but reading closely enough to catch any glancing mention of Selin. Meanwhile, Lou stacked up one old book after another, bookmarking relevant pages with knotted strings. C came and went at odd hours. When Dante's eyes grew strained, he sat back and closed them while she related stories and legends she'd culled from the streets of Narashtovic. The problem, however, was that none of these tales were about the Black Star itself. Instead, they used it as a storytelling device, a metaphor for things that were cryptic or obscure. And so young Hollander became as lost as Selin, for instance, or Gina's dreams remained as out of reach as the Black Star. The same pattern emerged in Lou's books. There had been a flash of mentions of Selin 400 years ago, during the High Dwardic period, but only as that same metaphorical device. Dante could only conclude an influential thinker had dredged up the term from the mists of the past, and other authors had quickly aped it as a way to display their erudition. Not terribly useful. And then he found Samaran's notes on Selin. His hopes soared. Hours later, they crashed like Vosk and his leather wings. While she had been aware of the phenomenon, teasing it out of a skein of classical references, her knowledge hadn't run any deeper than his own. In one sense, this was impressive, because She had been working with nothing but rumors and scattered mentions of a thing that, as far as Dante could tell, no one else had even known existed. In terms of useful information, however, there was just a single segment he might be able to use. 10 years? Total power. Rest Malin back to us, but to find it, to brush back the curtain so it will shine like a flame. And that was it. The rest was largely the same passages copied from the books Lou was bringing him. C's efforts fared no better. During the second week, the stories grew more and more outlandish. Aron pulled the serpent Gormer's heart from its chest, and it was so dark that all who saw it went blind. He had no choice but to stick it behind the night sky, where no one would see it. Dante began to suspect people were making them up on the spot to earn another payment. He burned through the materials in the citadel, and enlisted a slew of monks to help comb the public and private libraries distributed across Narashtovik. Even with so many extra eyes in the search, they turned up nothing of note. Strange, considering how strongly Samarant had felt about it, and how obviously the lights were flaring across the mountains. But maybe Selen hadn't appeared in a long, long time. Or maybe it was nothing more than pretty lights, and didn't deserve a detailed historical account at all. But he thought there was more to it. After 3 weeks of hunting, he strolled through Ollivander's open door. "Permission to sail away to foreign land, sir." Ollivander looked up from the paperwork he never seemed able to leave behind, the one trapping of office Dante most dreaded absorbing. "To any land in specific, or has all that reading finally driven you insane?" "Considering I've exhausted what Narashtovik knows, it would make sense to try anywhere else, but I have a more specific idea. The one place that knows everything. The Hukali Islands." Chapter 10 Blaze jogged up the staircase, through the cliff. Up top, the wind tousled the woman's hair. She stood in place, gazing at him as he wiped sweat from his temples and glanced across the plain far below for sight of Dante. "Well," he said, "aren't we going to head down to the caves, meet the other ladies?" "I brought you up here because I was tired of shouting," she said. "Now talk." "About what? The weather? This fog feels strange, but I assume you're used to it." "This is why we don't let outsiders in the pocket." She turned to go. "Hang on a second." He grabbed for her sleeve. As soon as he made contact, an icy jolt shot up his arm, paralyzing his fingers into claws. He yelped and jerked back, slipping on the damp rocks. He tipped toward the edge of the cliff. Before he could fall, he sat down hard and remained there, massaging his right hand. "That was rude," he said. She regarded him impassively. From most angles, she looked as young as he did, but in other moments she looked no less than 50. "More so than grabbing the clothes of a stranger? If you have more to say, quit wasting my time and spill it." I need to learn how to disappear. I know you've got more protecting you than these cliffs. What happens when someone approaches by sea, or one of you decides to take a vacation from the sanctum?" "We don't leave the pocket. When they come by sea, we seal the caves." Blaze sighed and closed his eyes. "Look, the fact you have to lie about it only proves you do have contact with outsiders. Last time I was here, all I saw was women. Unless you've got a very lucky man tucked away in a cave, new recruits have to come from somewhere." A streamer of mist shrouded the sun. In the dimmed light, she looked much older. "The man down there, is he here to kill you?" "I don't know what he intends. To blather at me, probably. But he's crazy enough to try to haul me away with him." He rubbed his hands down his face. "Does it matter? I'm sick of being hunted. I want to learn what you do. To be free." "How do I know you're not a spy?"
For who? The guy I'm trying to warn you about? Let him up here and see for yourself.
She smiled slightly.
Come with me to the shore. We'll see what the others have to say.
She turned and squelched through the muck. Ahead, gnarled black pillars rose from the plateau like the arms of plague victims. Cold fog billowed through the rocks, sliming them with condensation. It smelled like salt and the flatulent scent of peat. Insects squirmed in the lichen. The mist enveloped them, reducing visibility to 50 yards. The woman picked a careful trail through the columns and stagnant pools. Adrift in the fog, the walk felt eternal, yet it couldn't have lasted more than 15 or 20 minutes. Eventually, the plateau fell away, exposing a narrow strand of beach and an endless gray sea. She walked to a staircase built into the cliff and descended to the sand.
You will wait here, she said.
Righto.
She moved to the cliff face, brushed aside a leather curtain, and entered a dark cave. Blaze stood there a few minutes, rubbing his hands together to warm them back up after the chill of the plateau. The afternoon was growing late, and a bitter wind swept off the sea, bringing the smell of kelp and hollowed crabs. A group of women emerged from the cave. He stood up and smiled, but they ignored him and headed up the staircase to the bluff. It only took him a second. They were off to deal with Dante. He sat back down, got cold, stood up and wandered the strand, careful not to stray too far from the cave. Mist swirled overhead, but the beach itself was clear. The steam appeared to be materializing as currents of air moved from the sea to the land. Miles to the north and south, the cliffs curved inward, encircling Pocket Cove in a solid wall of stone. It was the world's finest fortress, and if Dante could be believed, the people of the Pocket had built it themselves to keep them safe from the conquering Gascon hordes. Blaze could almost believe it. The sun glowed from the waves so fiercely he thought it might melt the sand into glass and him into jam. It hung above the water, a perfect red ball he could stare right at without blinking. It touched the horizon and slid away with the slow, steady momentum of a beast with no fear of predators. As soon as its red rim winked behind the blue ledge, the woman appeared from the cave.
You can stay, she said, for now.
Blaze grinned.
I was afraid men weren't allowed.
Rarely. They have a habit of trying to take this place for themselves.
Well, I promise you'll find me as pliable as that pile of goo next to the seawater over there.
I'll take that in the spirit it's intended.
So, he said, got a name?
Min.
She walked toward him. Twilight softened her features, made her look younger again.
And it's the last name you get to learn until we know you.
Fair enough. Now can we go inside? I'm freezing.
Min swiveled her head toward the leather curtain shielding the cave mouth.
That is where the people of the Pocket live. Are you a person of the Pocket?
Is this a trick question?
You live here,
she gestured to the beach,
as we did when we first came here.
Blaze frowned.
If that's how it's going to be, it would have been nice to have some warning. I could have built a hut while you were in there talking.
We weren't expecting visitors, were we?
Your house, your rules. But if you come out here tomorrow and I'm a solid block of ice, at least have the courtesy to drop me in something alcoholic.
Min laughed twice, a quick, ha-ha, that sounded rusty from disuse.
I'll get you started.
She turned back toward the blank cliffs. On reaching their base, she drew a razor from her belt and touched it to the back of the first knuckle of the third finger of her left hand. Shadows bloomed in her hands. As Blaze watched, A wall of rock 6 feet long and 3 feet high emerged from the sand.
You can handle the rest, she said.
How about dinner? He said. Or am I catching my own fish too?
Can you?
With this? He smacked the sword on his hip. On a calm lake, on a clear day. In churned up waves approaching dark, I think I'll wind up eating sand cakes.
She pointed to the mist-fed falls a couple hundred yards upshore.
There's your water. Tonight I'll bring you food. After that, your needs are your own to meet.
I regret this immediately, he said.
Without another word, she returned to the caves. He took a deep breath and walked down to the tide line to gather driftwood and carry it back to the stone wall Min had conjured up. But there wasn't enough for a roof, let alone walls, and night was coming on fast. He propped a loose rafter system between the wall and the cliffs, then jogged back to the water to gather dried kelp. Tiny black flies swarmed in protest, and it was crackly and foul-smelling, but it was either that or shiver in the breeze all night. He layered it over the rafters. He had a half-decent roof by the time Min showed up. She'd lied. Not only did she bring him a wooden bowl of soup, fish and green onions, but she'd brought a blanket, too. She said her good night and returned to the cave. Blaze ate, tucked the bowl inside his hovel, and walled both sides up with kelp and driftwood. By the time he'd finished, it was dark and the wind had calmed to flickers. Inside the hut, which smelled like salt and sea stink, he found the blanket was just warm enough for him to drowse off. The coastal weather was a touch warmer than it had been inland, but unless he could build himself a fire pit and find both fuel and flint, he figured he had about a month to endear himself to the people of the pocket. If he still wasn't inside by then, he'd have to run away to some place that had actual shelter. Yet he went to bed unworried, feeling as light as the mist floating above the sands. It wasn't just that there had been no sign of Dante. It was the lightness of a new beginning. The purity of that allowed him, for the moment, to forget the rest. He beat the sun to rise. There was plenty of moon, so he took the opportunity to comb the beach in search of anything useful. A mile downshore, a spur of rock extended into the water. Dark, oblong shapes crusted the boulders. Mussels. He wasn't hungry enough to eat them raw, but it was always good to know you had a ready source of individually wrapped, snot-like ocean creatures at hand. He found a frayed length of rigging and slung it over his shoulders. Thatches of broad-leafed grass sprouted from the sand. He pulled up an armload and carried it back to his hovel. As light filtered in behind the eastern cliffs, he stripped away the kelp and clumsily wove himself a new, and much better-smelling, roof. Min walked out as he was sitting in the sand, rubbing his stomach and thinking about walking back down to the rocky spur.
"You're still here," she said. "Despite your best efforts."
She eyed his shelter.
"It looks like you'll be staying."
He laughed.
"That depends on whether my stomach agrees to hold down raw mussels."
"The stems of the grass you used for your roof are quite nourishing."
"Is that so? Do I have time to go fetch some, or is it time for my first lesson?"
"You have time," she said. "When the stomach is angry, the memory's lazy." He watched her a moment, expecting her to crack a smile, but had no such luck. He winked at her and padded up the beach. This time he tore the grass out at the base, gnawing on the thick white stems. It was salty, but there was a sweetness to it too, and it filled his belly so he couldn't complain. Except about it being grass. Once he'd had enough, he walked back to Min, who'd remained on the shore across from his shelter.
"So far, my role appears to be that of a new dog," he said. "I'm not allowed inside the home. You're my master. Fortunately for you, I'm housebroken. Sound about right?"
"That's the gist of it," she said. "To them, you're a mongrel.
You should be thrown out. But I respect what you want.